This is an interview with William Dove. Today is August 21st, 2013. We are on the top of McArdle Laboratory. I'm Molly Loss. So, Dr. Dove, I'd like to begin by asking you about your work with the perk rat. Why did you decide to create another model for gastrointestinal cancer to go along with the min-mouse?
Right. So, this is a further extension of the path that I described on the 16th, that in each case that we've gotten into a new area, we've chosen an area whose biology has been an important way to study a particular issue. So not all organisms show all biological phenomena. Some show a particular phenomenon more clearly than another. As we worked on the min mouse, we discovered that most of the intestinal tumors that it forms are in the small intestine. And we wanted to know whether that was true of all animal models for colon cancer. Certainly in the human, mutations in the very same gene that is affected in the min mouse, mutations in that human gene lead to colonic tumors, not very many tumors in the small intestine. And so we decided to diversify and ask whether if we create the same kind of genetic lesion in the laboratory rat, do we get what we observe in the mouse? Or do we get what we observe in the human or something else? Well, now here, some of the strength of McArdle came to play because several laboratories going way back to Van Potter have used the laboratory rat to study cancer. Dr. Pito followed using the rat. Michael Gould joined McArdle some decade or so ago and studies mammary cancer in the rat. And many of the molecular features of breast cancer in the rat are closer to that of the human. The other connection was really coming out of our lab, where Alexandra and others in our group had made germline mutagenesis practical in the mouse, and those methods of germline mutagenesis were then taken over to the rat by Michael Gould and his colleagues. So here was some lateral transfer of ways of doing experiments. So we then set up a collaboration with Michael Gould. He had a very large mutagenesis program going, and we were able to monitor the animals that emerged in his program for mutations in our gene of interest. So this was very efficient, that if we had to set up our own rat mutagenesis, that would have been extremely costly. Instead, we could piggyback on Michael's mutagenesis. I had a graduate student, Larry Kwong, and an excellent postdoctoral fellow named Jim Amos Landgraf, who designed a screen for a mutation in the rat that affected this gene called APC. And indeed, looking at something like over 1,300 offspring of mutagenized males, 1,300, it took more than a year to screen this many animals. They found an animal that did carry a mutation in this gene. The question then was whether this mutation led to any disease at all. If it did it lead to the same thing found in the mouse? Was the rat just like the mouse? Or did it lead to a disease in the colon, as in the human? many cases where mutations are made in animals, there is no phenotype at all, because the set of genes in mammals involve a lot of compensation, and it isn't enough to mutate one gene to get a strong phenotype. So we are prepared for there being no phenotype. Well, what we observed is that, as with the human, the rat that carries a mutation in APC develops tumors in the colon, mostly in the colon. And so the rat was not named polyposis in the rat colon, or PERC for short, just as the mouse had been named multiple intestinal neoplasia, or MIN for short. And we've then developed a number of experiments for which the rat is more suitable than the mouse. So the sort of driving observation was that it resembled the human in its distribution of tumors to the colon. That was the driving observation. But there have been further observations that we've been able to find in the rat that allow us to carry on experiments there in parallel to work that we do in the mouse. Now, the genetics of the mouse is highly developed. There are many things one can do to manipulate the germline of the mouse to turn genes on and off in particular tissues. It's really a remarkable genetic platform. By contrast, the rat, it's not zero. It's certainly, there are a large number of inbred rat strains. There are not yet all of the different mutated alleles in the rat that exist in the mouse. The rat is beginning to catch up. Much that can now be done in the mouse will be done in 5 or 10 years' time in the rat. For us, what's dominant is the initial biology, that a defect in this particular gene gives the human-like disease. And you can't make the mouse behave that way, or at least not very efficiently. So that's a really important reason that we've been doing a lot of our work in the rat, and we encourage the whole field of rat genetics to catch up with what now is done in the mouse, and it's happening.
So did you work out a similar means of sharing the PERC mouse with your colleagues as you did with the MIN mouse? Is it free? Is it freely available?
Right. So there's a small difference in that Worf decided to issue for a patent on the PERC rat. When the MIN mouse was discovered, the molecular lesion was found by a collaboration with a group at Johns Hopkins. And we learned belatedly that they were being supported by a very large drug company called Huffman La Roche, which wanted to patent the MIN mouse. But by then, in our view, the MIN mouse had been developed and had been circulated. We didn't feel that it was beneficial to put patent protection on the MIN mouse, and our colleagues at Hopkins agreed with us, allowed then Jackson Laboratory to make the MIN mouse available around the world. They charged a royalty to commercial outfits, but they made it freely available to academic researchers. And it's quite striking that, I think I mentioned that the MIN mouse has been published hundreds of times, and the Oncomouse, which was very restricted by DuPont, has published just a handful of papers in the 20 years since the two have existed. The PERC rat is not yet broadly used, but we have made it available that Wharf agreed to license it to Taconic under conditions that academic investigators could obtain and breed the perk rat. So it has the same open access that the min mouse has, and it's simply a matter that not as many labs in the world use rats as use mice. But the ones who then come to see that they can learn certain things more appropriately in the perk rat will have access to it, thanks to Taconic and Wharf. So I discussed the perk rat by emphasizing the McArdle links that enabled us to work in the rat between our group and Michael Gould's group. I think that I also want to emphasize that none of this would happen without this terrific graduate student, Larry Kwong, and this terrific postdoc, Jim Amos Landgraf. And further, that the rat community now in McArdle includes not only Michael Gould, but also Jim Scholl. So beyond Potter and Pito, now there are two fully committed rat genetics groups, cancer genetics groups, and we benefit from their presence.
So I was interested as to why your work on mammalian cancer centers on gastrointestinal cancer. Is there anything particular about that type of cancer that makes it a very interesting question for you, or a good particular cancer to work on?
Well, I said at the beginning yesterday that that my trajectory is opportunistic. So when we used ENU mutagenesis on the mouse, this was the first cancer-related model, the MIN model. So it immediately focused us on intestinal cancer. And there are many reasons why this is important to understand. It's the second most, between both males and females, if you add them together, it's the second most prevalent cancer in the industrial, in the advanced world. And of the 50,000 approximately cases found in this country per year, only half of them will survive. The other half will die of their cancer. So even though it's a late onset cancer, it has a very poor prognosis, especially when advanced. It has a very good prognosis if detected early. So that was the last word that I mentioned on the 16th, how important is early detection. And much of what we do now with the perk rat uses some of its advantages to work with investigators who are exploring ways to detect colon cancer early. The rat has been favored by biochemists because it's larger and you can get more tissue. So you can easily get a much larger blood sample from a rat than from a min mouse. Mm-hmm. So some of our investigations together with the Biotechnology Center involve markers found in blood. Are there markers found in blood of tumor-positive animals, not in tumor-negative animals? So the rat enhances our ability to study methods for early detection. You may wonder, why do I say that colon cancer is especially prime if one can improve the early detection? It's that an early tumor can be excised not by taking out the whole colon, but by taking out the tumor, the polypectomy. And there are very few risks in polypectomy. There are some, but very few. And once this early tumor is taken out, the tissue heals itself and the patient is fine and cancer free. Early detection becomes a cure because of that.
So I'd like to maybe shift gears a little bit, if that's okay with you, to talk about McArdle, beginning with you telling me, please, how you were recruited here.
Right. So you could... There's one document that I sent you as my 60th birthday tribute to Howard Temin. Howard organized that birthday symposium. Didn't quite survive to be there, but he was certainly there in spirit. So I sent you a discussion about some of that history, and how it relates to McArdle. So I was hired by Harold Rush, had been a postdoc in England, then came to this country without a job and had a number of interviews across the country, and came up to Madison on a cold January day. And this is always a good way to recruit, because if somebody can't stand the cold, they probably shouldn't come here. So anyway, both my wife and I happened to like the cold. Came up in the mid-January, and Harold Rush was the chair, and I spent a good deal of time talking with him, and typical of McArdle, talking to every faculty member. So hiring has been, and I hope it will continue to be, a matter that the whole faculty at every level inputs their opinions and interacts with the candidate. So I knew that there were faculty members with whom I had mutual interest, particularly in chemistry, because my degree was in chemistry, but there were some very strong chemists on the faculty at that time. Chemists who were interested in cancer, not just chemistry. But James Miller was an outstanding physical organic chemist, and his wife Betty was his companion. Less of a chemist and more of a biologist was she. Charles Heidelberger was, again, a brilliant synthetic organic chemist who had made 5-fluorouracil, which still is an important chemotherapeutic. Roz Boutwell, also trained in biochemistry. And so these were people who loved molecules and loved to understand things through how molecules acted. As a postdoc, I had become really committed, as I've mentioned, to using genetics as the top-down compared to the bottom-up approach to understand things. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a great deal of genetics, but Howard Temin was the closest. He had done some genetic experiments in gaining evidence for the integrated provirus, mm-hmm. which was a genetic element derived from retrovirus. So he had done some genetics, and certainly could talk genetics. Vaclav Cebulski was a very active geneticist, interested in the genetics of somatic cells. And certainly he probably understood my work on Lambda more than any of the faculty, and indeed, within a few years, began to work himself in that area. Those were my connections. upon interview, and so within a few days, Harold Rush called to make me an offer, and I was, as I said, was making a trip across the country, and was, by good fortune, was being made several offers that I was actively considering, and at the same time, I was courting my future wife, Alexandra, who at that time was in Paris, and she joined me during that, soon after I had been in Madison, soon after that, January of 64, and we were married in June of 64, and we jointly decided that really Madison gave us the best opportunity for doing our work and for raising our family. So we then became part of the McArdle family. So there's then these series of incarnations of the McArdle family or community to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what was it like when you first arrived in 1965?
Well, when I accepted the position, I had no lab, and so I stayed in California until my lab was ready to work. So when I then did arrive, my lab was almost ready to work. And my neighbor on the sixth floor was Charles Heidelberger. So I had a lot to do with him at the beginning and worked with one of his graduate students in sort of getting started. From the beginning until now, McArdle faculty had a special feature that most of its faculty meetings, which would happen almost every week, would be devoted to research. So this is different from other departments at Wisconsin and different from most other places, not all. There are a few other places where this is also the case. But McArdle was special at Wisconsin because its faculty meetings were largely devoted to research. And so there I draw special attention to people who made that kind of research format dynamic and always active. One was Van Potter, and Van Potter was always full of ideas and a very interactive person. He would often comment on a seminar or something that he had read. So he was really important and making those faculty meetings dynamic, not just canned talks, but dynamic. The other important person who really made sure that these faculty meetings always happened was Betty Miller. And to the end of her life, she always made sure that the faculty meeting was being scheduled, even if when she was associate director, Henry Pito was the director, and he had a lot of national and international responsibilities, but Betty was always making sure that faculty meeting would happen and that research would be discussed. Mm-hmm. When we moved to the era of Norman Drinkwater, Norman brought a special combination that he understood the research in McArdle, and he became one of those whose genetics synergized with my own. Norman is an excellent geneticist, and but he understood both the chemistry and the genetics that was going on in McArdle, and so he was able to write summaries of research talks that were quite precise, quite accurate, quite. So if somebody had missed a staff meeting, they could find out from Norman's notes some of the details of what had been talked about. So.
So in what ways were your own work, was your own work enriched by these staff meetings? Did you take any of your own ideas from them?
I would say only sort of osmotically, Molly. A lot of discussion of cancer and what the problems were, and what was going on, and which I listened to. I told you last time that there was some pressure that I do somatic cell genetics the way Dr. Schabalsky does, did at the time. And in my understanding of genetics, I believed that this was not fully rational. I say rational, I'm not sure that's the right adjective, but that dealing with cells whose ploidy is not controlled and is very often many copies of the same gene, that in order to dissect the system genetically, you need a system which is in which the genes are there in single copy, are really subject to changing the phenotype. If you mutate the gene, if there are many copies, you can't change the phenotype by mutating one of the many copies. So anyway, when I would give staff meeting, which was always on Lambda, which was a rational organism with which I could study the control of replication in ways that now are known to be important for mammalian replication, the question whether I could do similar studies in mammalian cells would come up, but I would have to, not rudely, but quietly say, I don't want to go there. Things changed, as I talked about on Friday. Methods came along, and some of them developed by our lab and some around the world, and things changed, and I could do work that then connected to what I had osmotically incorporated by participating in the McArdle faculty.
So I'm curious about your impressions of Harold Rush as a director of McArdle.
Right. So one must first of all say that Rush had hired everybody, so there was a sort of familial affinity. He was sort of the father to every one of us. Secondly, McArdle was smaller than it is now. Though Rush had done some experimental work, he became allergic to animals and just found his talents better used as administrator and talking to people. So he wasn't actively doing research, but he had done enough research, and he had a deep interest in cancer that he could talk with any one of us. His special talent is that he could come into a room and talk to you, to Betty, to me, to anybody. He didn't come in like a bull in a china shop, or he didn't strike fear just because he used the director. He had a very friendly approach. Some people call it Midwestern. Anyway, he had a friendly approach and could come into labs, and did come into labs. So he would come into my lab when I was small, and as it was larger, he would come into the lab and people would enjoy talking with him. So that was pretty effective at building a family out of McArdle, mind you, when it was small. I'd say both Henry Pito and Norman Drinkwater, they've made their connections to labs in a quite different way, not with this personable approach, one-on-one approach. But Henry Pito has done the histology, the pathology for all groups that do true cancer research, that work with animals that develop cancer, Henry's been the one that he's been interacting with us scientifically in that way. Norman, in a different way, has really been the go-to person in regard to statistical analysis of data, and gives a course every other year, and most of the groups in McArdle connect with Norman that way. Those are each quite different than what Harold Rush brought to McArdle. And so I think it's simply a matter of both the growth in size and of the nature of these connections with the director, that McArdle is less of a family now than it was under Rush.
So if it's less of a family, would there be a different way of characterizing it? Like how would you characterize it now?
Well, so I guess, I mean, family isn't the only kind of community. It is a community, and I think it's worth talking about that. How is it a community, if not a family? Is that a fair distinction to make?
I think so. So how would you characterize it?
So it's a community because, A, the staff meeting of evolving research is still central. Two, the McArdle graduate student cohort is really paid attention to by the faculty, in particular faculty. Paul Lambert is one, Dan Loeb is another, Norman Drinkwater is a third, who spend a lot of time with the graduate student presentations and keeping in touch with them, serving on their committees. A great sense of responsibility to the McArdle graduate students. McArdle seminar comes and goes. So during the time of Betty Miller, it was very actively supported by the faculty. Since then, it's been sporadic. With Jim Schull, he's attempting to make it much more fully supported, so that it's a community effort whereby many of the people who are in McArdle will have gone to the McArdle seminar every Wednesday morning and would come back to their labs and would talk about it, the science that went on. Mm-hmm. So this is Jim Schull's attempt to bring some kind of community in through the seminar route. Mm-hmm. So noting that Jim Schull has wanted to do that, I've bought into that, although I'm an emeritus faculty member. Mm-hmm. And I think Carolyn Alexander has some of the same feeling, to try to tie our graduate students more intimately to the McArdle seminar, the weekly McArdle seminar. So we have an experiment going on called the Speaker Chat, whereby the speaker meets afterwards with the students who are interested in what he or she has talked about. This is a pale model of what goes on in the GenX program, where it's actually a course. In the spring semester of the first and second year, the graduate students not only read two papers that each speaker has published, but raise questions on the basis of their reading before the speaker comes, and then meet with the speaker. Sometimes the speaker is terrified to meet with these students. Meet with the speaker afterwards in a so-called round table. So this is a pale mirror of what goes on in genetics, and which is so successful at building community in that group of people. But anyway, it's through the seminar that I think there can be a stronger sense of community. in McArdle.
So I'd like to maybe return a little bit to asking about individual people. So I'd like to know your impressions of Václav Sobolsky.
Well, once when I was a graduate student at Caltech, a postdoc in Stanford, Joshua Lederberg was one of the leading intellectuals there, and he was designing probes to go up to Mars to find out if there was life on Mars. And the bottom line is that the most general way to find out if there's life on a planet is to probe and see if you get a reaction. So this is what Sobolsky loves to do. He loves to get a reaction by challenging. And he's been that way for as long as I've known him, which is almost 50 years. He's been that way, he continues to be that way. I think that he's been very inventive. He's come up with a number of really important technical contributions to science. He's been very supportive of his people and has brought people largely from Eastern Europe and given them a chance to do research. I think his one-to-one personal interactions are absolutely the opposite of Harold Rush's, that perhaps in large part because he likes to challenge people, but perhaps for other reasons he doesn't have the personal affinity that Rush was able to develop with all of his people that he hired. So how about wild card as a summary?
What do you mean?
Wild card. Václav Sobolsky is a wild card. He's not sort of part of the standard McArdle deck. He does things quite independently and likes to challenge the consensus. So, it's good for an organization to have some people who challenge the organization. It's good. And I think McArdle has responded to these challenges.
What were your impressions of Howard Temin?
So, of course, he too challenges, is famous for challenging dogma. His biological insight is just unmatched, and his commitment to pursuing science in depth and going for the final truth, no matter whether it was what he predicted or not, I think he stands very high in my estimation that way. And I said some of that in my tribute in that little document that I sent to you, that he always believed that any idea that he published was not automatically true. It had to be confirmed by others to become more likely to be true. He had a really good level of, I don't want to call it, I guess cynicism might be approximately the right word, but yeah, he would be able to pick up various alternative motivations that people would have for what they do. I think he was a good critic of people's motivations. And in science there are lots of people who are out for fame or to use a metaphor I sometimes use, who are interested in making a killing rather than a living in doing science. think he was good at picking up that. I think after he became diagnosed, and he was diagnosed at an advanced stage of the lung cancer that hit him, that he developed a very mature, soft side to him that hadn't been as present before he was diagnosed. And very considerate of everybody around him, especially near the end of his life.
It's 3:20.
Okay. Maybe then we can pick up the next session with finishing these questions.
Good. So I will want to talk next time around about the McArdle community going beyond the faculty and the director course and the faculty, going beyond them, how important this is, and briefly touch